Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And I'm Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team. And today we have nobody. We could say that it's because we wanted to do a hostful episode where we just talked about internal stuff that we happen to know stuff about. Or we could imagine a world where we don't get around to asking guests until it's too late and we're organizing things last minute. You can imagine whichever solution is preferable to you.
Well, we do have some cool stuff to talk about.
We do. In fact, there's a bunch of stuff that's new, some of which we don't know anything about. So, like, there's a bunch of new devices. I just got a Google Home for my home just to see what one of those things is like. And there's all these Wi-Fi things. I know nothing about those, so let's not talk about those.
Oh, I've been using mine. I love it.
Yeah, it's fun. It's interesting. But I don't know any of the technical details. It's just, it's magic, basically.
Right.
But there's other stuff that's more Android specific that I think would be interesting to talk about. So let's do that.
Okay, so I guess today we'll talk about Android 7.1.
7.1, which we affectionately call MR1.
Yeah. again, we call something MR1 after every release.
Yeah, it's a recurring name because it's such a nice name, right? We just want to reuse something like that.
And if it's not obvious, MR stands for maintenance release.
Is that what it stands for? Okay, all right. I was thinking it was monumental. Monumental refactoring.
Yeah, we try not to do that in the MR releases. and then, of course, we could briefly mention Studio 2.2, but maybe more exciting is Studio 2.3, Ooh. Which at the time of this recording has not been released, but hopefully will be when you hear this.
I will be, I'm going to pretend to be an audience during that point because I know some of the stuff that came out in 2.2, which I can talk about a little bit, but I don't know the stuff that's in 2.3. So that'll be cool. Also, there's been a bunch of support library releases, some of which we've talked about and some of which we haven't, so we can talk about that, and we can also talk about the new device that is relevant to us, which is the new Pixel phones, which you can now order. They've gone sort of, they've flopped states occasionally. I went there to buy a phone for a spouse, and it said no. But then I went back a couple of days later, and it let me buy one. So it was just teasing me, I think. These phones are interesting. So this is not the sponsored part of the show where we just say an ad for going and buying these devices. But I think they're interesting because, they're really nice. It's a nice combination of sort of form factor and hardware and capabilities. But it's also representative of, you know, directions that we're taking the platform in, just like the Nexus phones always were. But these are, you know, a bit more premium experience where we sort of did the finishing details, I think, a little more completely. So we've been testing these phones internally for a while, so, you know, playing around with the camera and stuff. I think the thing that's most noticeable to me, I don't know what your experience is, but the camera app itself, like, I think it finally came together in terms of the app capabilities and the capabilities of the hardware, because I feel like it struggled in the last couple of releases where the capabilities that the application required didn't quite match the capabilities of, you know, the CPU and the GPU and the memory constraints that it was running under. So, you know, it's creating these massive surfaces and dealing with all this media in the background, which means you really need the horsepower to handle that. And I feel like these devices finally have it, so it can just sort of seamlessly take you to the app, take you to the pictures.
But I think the camera is probably my favorite part, right? And the fact that it is so fast, that it starts quickly, and when you tap the button, it autofocuses very quickly, which was, you know, it wasn't always the case with the 5X.
Yep.
And it takes a picture immediately, right? So you sort of, and you could tap it multiple times really quickly, right, or even hold the button and it grabs a bunch of pictures. Right. And I've taken advantage of that, right? So now when I take a picture, I usually take 10, 12, 15 pictures in rapid succession and then just pick the best one.
I also rely more on HDR. Like, I have it by default in HDR Plus mode. I actually
which
don't
it,
know
it
the
ships with by default, by the way. So it's sort of like you have to know to turn it off if that's what you want. But I don't really see why you'd want to, because it does an amazing job. I think, you know, I think if you're a photographer, maybe you have really specific feelings about what the picture should look like. But I think if you're just like, hey, this is I want to remember this scene, just press the button, and it does a pretty good job because of HDR. It gets the dark parts of the picture, as well as the light ones, without washing either one out, which I guess is the main point of HDR.
Yeah, I think it captures, if I understand it correctly, it captures the picture with different exposures and then combines those into a single image so that it can get the exposure correct for highly contrasted parts of the image. I think if you're a professional photographer, you probably take separate pictures and then you go and spend all day in Photoshop to produce that one image, and that's not really a priority for me. But I do remember on previous devices, when we didn't ship it on by default, I would turn it on occasionally because I would need it, and then I would turn it off very soon because it took so long to process that thing.
I think the problem with HDR, you have to have a very fast camera, because what it did before was it would take two pictures, but because it was slow, there was a lag between the two, right? And so if the subject isn't completely still or your hand isn't completely steady, it would get blurry, right? And that doesn't seem to happen now because it's able to take them instantaneously.
Yep. So that works well. What's the other aspect? There's image stabilization for videos. That's nice. I don't tend to take a lot of videos on the phone anyway. But so here's something cool. This is sort of a geeky detail of one of the things that's very noticeable, I think, if you're using the device is, and I think they mentioned it at the product launch or announcement or something, is decreased touch latency. So one of the reasons that it feels faster is that there is reduce latency between, like, when you touch the screen and do something, fling the list or scroll something or tap a button or whatever, and the time when you actually see the updates that result from that touch, right? So the question is, why? Why is that faster? I mean, obviously, CPU and GPU are better, but just having, you know, faster hardware doesn't give you increased touch latency automatically because we're still running at 60 frames a second, right? So if we're still processing things on these frame boundaries, then how did things get magically faster? And it turns out the answer is always clever engineering. Okay, so let me see if I can walk through this. It took me a while to sort of understand, talking to the graphics folks, why this got faster. And then I have this really complicated diagram where I sort of walk through it slowly and try to explain it. But let me see if I can do this verbally and not tie myself in knots. Imagine a world prior to Hardware Composer 2. So I should point out that this works on Pixel, but it will also work on any other phones that opt into enabling the same features in Hardware Composer 2. So it's not specific to Pixel. It's just that this is the first place where it actually came out.
And when you say that, you mean that when someone builds a system image for a phone, yeah, that's when they decide that they configured the system image in a certain way based on the hardware available, and that's where they would opt into this.
Yes, okay. Right. So this is, think of this as like the first place where you will see this particular capability. And maybe other manufacturers have a similar way of solving the same problem. I don't know. I'm mostly familiar with the phones that we produce here. So imagine this world prior to these phones or prior to Hardware Composer 2, where everything was lockstep on the vertical refresh boundary. So we have these frame boundaries that happen every, you know, roughly 16 milliseconds. So when we do this vertical refresh sync, we say, okay, now's the time when we batch up all the input events that have occurred, and we go to the UI thread and say, you know, process your input events, process your animations, process your layout and measurement and drawing, and also on the same sync, push things to the GPU. So we do sort of the buffer flip operation where we exchange the buffers around so that we can now start drawing to a new thing, and then the GPU starts processing the GPU commands. So the typical way that things happen is that we take all the input commands, we send it to the UI thread, the UI thread processes all this stuff as fast as it can, and then it asks for the buffer to be flipped. So if it can do all of that stuff within one frame, which is within 16 milliseconds, then it will push the stuff to the GPU on the next frame boundary, which is 16 milliseconds later. And then those operations will be seen two frames after that, right? So you can imagine all of the touch latency, all of the touch operations are going to be batched up and then seen, in the best case, 32 milliseconds later. However, because it's very difficult sometimes for applications to do everything they can on every single frame within 16 milliseconds, sometimes they go over, and then we very typically get into a situation where we have triple buffering enabled, which means that even if you can get everything done within 16 milliseconds, it's actually not going to show up for another two frames, which means the time between batching up all the input stuff and actually seeing the results on the screen can be, and typically is, as high as 48 milliseconds, right? Does this make sense so far?
That doesn't sound awesome.
Right. I mean, it's fairly quick. This is 1/20th of a second, but, you know, noticeable over time is just sort of a lag. It's dealable, but it is noticeable when you get something better. And the reason that you can get something better is now we stagger when we do these things. So now we have a process where instead of doing everything on the frame boundary, we actually stagger when we do things. So we wait, I think it's like 4 milliseconds before we actually batch up the input stuff. We wait another 4 milliseconds until we do the buffer flip operation, right? So now all of a sudden we are doing things at different times, and this is where I wave my hands and need a diagram to do this appropriately. But now essentially we have 20 milliseconds to do all of the processing of input information and doing all the UI operations before we push it to the GPU. That means we have 4 more milliseconds to do all these operations, which means we're more typically not going to get into a triple buffering situation, which means now instead of 48 milliseconds, we've cut it down to 32 milliseconds. Not only that, but we also waited 4 milliseconds to start processing the input, which means we got another 4 millisecond advantage from what we had before. So we've got another 4 milliseconds to wait and have more input events to batch up, which means now instead of 48 milliseconds, we've got 28 milliseconds.
28 milliseconds between the sort of the last input and the first visual reaction to
Correct.
It. So that
right.
then it feels more responsive.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for the conclusion, because with all the words I used, that probably wasn't
Why didn't you just say that?
Because it's not as interesting. I really like the technical details. It's not obvious to me whether I explain them in a way that people understand them. But basically, stuff is faster, so it feels better. I think that's the main takeaway.
Yeah, no, the phone does really feel good.
All right.
So, I think all the animations seem really smooth, too.
Yeah, and I think that is more ascribable directly to, well, the CPU is faster, the GPU is faster. Like, we're able to do more stuff in the same amount of time simply because we have more raw horsepower, right?
Yeah.
I think just the characteristics of the system that we put together means we can do stuff faster. That also means, you know, we can do stuff without tripping the triple buffering situation that we did before. So, yeah, overall, faster experience, but the touch latency itself, I thought, was sort of clever engineering on top of the raw hardware characteristics.
Cool. Another feature I like on the Pixel, which I used last night, it was election night, so I had a hard time falling asleep afterwards. And so I was trying to read to sort of just put myself to sleep. But, you know, if you read on a white screen, it sort of doesn't put you to sleep. So what I've been using in the past is the Google Play Books app. It has this ability to have, like, night lights where it sort of switches the screen to only, like, soft yellow tones, which is better for your eyes to not wake up. On the Pixel, we have a mode now where it turns the whole UI into sort of, it changes all the colors so that they're sort of more conducive to not waking up. So I think it filters out blue light or something like that. The problem with the book solution was that, you know, if you get curious and you want to check, you know, mail or whatever, that notification is going to be crispy white and blue, right? Whereas now the entire UI is...
device-wide.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just kind of nice, I think. So I've set it up now so that, you know, every night around 9 or 10, it switches over to this mode automatically and, you know, returns the next morning. So,
do you set the time when it flips into that?
Yes, you can. I mean, there are multiple options. You can either set it... One of the options is turn it off and on manually. Another option is sunrise and sunset. I think that's one of the built-in ones, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, turning it on at sunset's a little early for me. I mean, that's like around here, that's 7 p.m. now, you know, and I don't quite need the sleepy light at 7 p.m.
Right. Or in London, it would automatically come on at like 2 in the afternoon.
I assume it's local time. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, you're saying just for the... London's pretty far south, though.
I
grew up near the Arctic Circle, so that's why I'm like, hey, London, that's far, far south. And, you know, you can also set the time yourself, which is what I've done. So I think that's kind of a nice feature.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard of other people using it. It's like a red tint, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think the idea is it filters out blue light.
Okay.
White light, you know, has all the wavelengths, I guess. And there's some of them that really stimulate your brain and says, time to be awake. And so you don't want that light. And I have noticed it just is calmer for me, at least, in the evening.
Nice. I'm trying to think if there was other new sort of
The other
user
big feature,
features.
I think, on the Pixel, of course, is the tight integration with the Assistant. So I've been dealing with the Assistant a lot lately because I also have been testing the new Google Home, right? So that plus on the Pixel phone. I think it's in Allo as well, but I think the big difference on the Pixel is that it's tied to your home button, right? So wherever you are, just long press that button and you're in the Assistant.
Right.
So, you know, seems kind of cool.
Yeah, or the verbal thing, which is more like the Google Home as well, sort of the key phrase to get into it.
Yes.
You want to take that approach?
Yeah.
Which is tricky at home. Like, so now we have this Google Home at home, and I'll use that trigger phrase and all the phones in the house will react accordingly. they're just all dying to help me, which is so nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So let's move off the devices and into the platform release itself. So in MR, in maintenance releases, we typically don't do a lot of feature work, but there were a couple of outstanding features and ideas that we had coming either from the work that we had been doing for getting the Pixel phones ready to go, or because they weren't quite solidly baked in the Nougat release, but they were ready by the time we got around to the 7.1 release. So I wanted to call out a couple of those. So that feature in particular, which we wanted in the Nougat release and didn't quite make it, was app shortcuts. So if you've been following the releases carefully, I think that came out in preview one, but we should have called it teaser one instead, because when we yanked the feature after that, because it wasn't quite ready for prime time. And when we do things in the platform that require APIs, like, we have to be happy with that forever, because we can't exactly change the APIs later. So we backed it out and we worked on the feature more, and now it's in there for real. So app shortcuts, you will see this if you long press on one of the apps that supports it. Some of the apps that ship with the device support it by default. I can't remember which ones exactly. They will expose deep links into the application. So, for example, you could have a chat application like Hangouts, where maybe you've had a recent chat with Tor. Sometimes I do. And maybe that's exposed as a shortcut directly. So I can long press in the app instead of going into the app and then finding Tor and, you know, scrolling down and clicking and getting back to that conversation. I can actually just long press on the icon instead and see a deep link to that conversation go immediately to the chat with Tor, so that I can bother him some more. And so there's two types of app shortcuts. There's dynamic and static. So static is you're exposing deep links into the application or into activities in the app. For things that you know at build time. So I know that, you know, someone is going to want to access the, you know, maps feature built into my driving application or whatever. So I will expose that at build time, and there will always be a standard shortcut that gets exposed. And then the other ones are dynamic shortcuts that you can create on the fly. And those are more like the conversations. The application will recognize that I've just had a conversation with Tor, and it will expose a deep link to that conversation. And there are standard ways of doing this to provide information for the shortcut. You've got an icon for the information, you have a label for the shortcut, and then you have an intent that you're going to launch that deep link or a set of deep links if you want sort of a back stack to navigate back out through. So that's sort of a major-ish feature that almost made N and not quite, and now it's out in the 7.1 release. Another smaller one, a single API point here, which people will notice on the Pixel device, probably not other devices for now, is round icons. The intent here was to provide a consistent but slightly different visual interface to the device itself. So you have these applications with these round icon experiences on the Pixel phone. The interesting thing here is that obviously you can always provide a round icon. We're not stopping you from drawing a circle in your app icon right now. But what we did by adding a new API was to provide the ability to provide different icons. So depending on what device you're being installed on and whether they support the round icons or not, you will get an icon that is more consistent with the rest of the device. So if you said, hey, round icons are a great idea, I'm going to create a round icon, then on systems where typically the icons are rectangular, you would not get icons that are consistent with everything else. You would have a round icon and everyone else would be rectangular. So the intent was provide icons that are consistent with the experience for all of the rest of the applications. So on those other devices, you're going to get, you know, the same icons as everybody else. But on a device that supports round icons, we will note on the Pixel phone, okay, they support a round icon, and we'll supply that icon automatically to the launcher.
So if they don't support a round icon, do we make one from the other icon?
We do not. Okay. We just take the other icon that they have provided. We do not change the icon along the way.
Okay.
It is, of course, very difficult to create a round icon, so imagine it'll take everybody a long time to do this. But the interesting thing is it's not a launcher capability. It's a device capability. So the launcher is just handed an icon. It's the device itself that makes the decision about which icon to use here. Right. So we will the device has the ability to look at the manifest at the APK and say, okay, they've supplied both. I will take the round icon. Or if they haven't supplied both, they'll just take the other icon and supply.
Couldn't the launcher do the same thing, or is this not available to it?
I don't believe there's an API point for launcher to get that information. I think they only know about the icon that the system provided.
Okay.
On the other hand, it means that the launcher doesn't have to be rewritten for this capability. They're going to inherit it automatically.
Right.
Let's see. You want to talk about some tools? I've been talking for a while.
Tools, yes. All right. So I guess when you gave this presentation, you talked about 2.2, which had recently gone final.
So the presentation, just for context, I gave a presentation on what's new in Android that covers a lot of similar information at DroidCon London a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
All right,
so
go.
This was just basically reusing the slides, so there was no prep necessary. See earlier discussion about unprepared podcast host. So at the time, we had just shipped Android Studio 2.2, and I think that if you're a listener of this podcast, you're probably familiar with the big new features in 2.2, because we've had special episodes about it, right? So constraint layout, we had a bunch of people on, I guess in April, May, before I.O. We talked about that. We talked about the Espresso test recorder. Yep. There are a bunch of new features in 2.2. I'm actually more excited to talk about 2.3.
Oh, come on. But we have to at least mention the other ones. You may find them boring because you've been looking at them for months, but they just came out like six weeks ago.
All right, go.
So quick laundry list. So APK Analyzer, I think that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Like find out not only how big your APK is, but why it is actually that big. Where are all those, what's causing the size increase and running a diff between different APKs. So if you got bigger, take a look at where the asset sizes or where the sizes overall are coming from in both versions to see, okay, for this complicated application, where is all my bulk coming from and what can I do about it?
It's also just a good way, I think, if you want to look inside an APK. It's like your file explorer for an APK, because it'll show you the contents of files. You can see the content. You can see what an icon looks like. You can sort of see how the resources are packed. So it's a good visualizer for that.
Nice. Samples browser. This is like click on, you know, some text, and with the context of that text, we'll go and find one of the standard samples if it is related.
Yeah, so
it.
If you start, you know, you start typing in Google API client or whatever, right? And you're like, actually, I'm not sure how to use this class. You can right-click on the symbol, say, show me some samples for this. And then you sort of get to see the recommended samples that are using that same API to see how they're using it. That's sometimes easier than trying to, you know, read the Java docs or you know, Google something and end up on Stack Overflow and finding some snippet there.
Building native apps. So CMake and NDK Make both supported now.
Yep. Yeah, we shipped the C++ or the NDK support in 1.4, so over a year ago, but at the time it was in preview mode. And in 2.2, it graduated to be a stable supported feature. And the biggest addition was that we now support some external build systems. So you can, in your Gradle project, say, I'm using an external build system to build C++. And then, you know, you put little stanza in the file and say, I'm using CMake, and then you point to the CMake file, for example. Or I think we also support some other options that I can't think of right now.
You put what in the file? Did you say stanza?
Yeah.
What's that?
S-T-A-N-Z-A.
Yeah.
Like a little...
Stanza. They call that a stanza in America.
Sorry.
Stanza. Wow. What an official way of referring to
it. I don't know how to pronounce it.
I mean, do you actually write like rhyming verse in there? That would be cool.
So sure, everyone already knows that I'm not a native English speaker.
Well, now they do.
So, yeah. Yep.
But you're a much better English speaker, so that makes up
stanza. There's a stanza you put in your build Gradle file.
Beautiful. Yeah. Oh, I know what that is, but I still associate it with poetry.
You basically record what it is you want to build the native code with, and then Gradle will call it at the right time and then look in the right place for the artifacts that it then packages into the APK.
Okay. Let's see. I think the other one was my favorite 2.2 thing, which was instant run fixes, which means this is not like a really cool feature. Instead, it's an admission that maybe one of the features that we had before wasn't quite ready.
Yeah, instant run. Oh, boy. We had a podcast about it. I guess we spoke a lot about it back when we released 2.0 preview 5, and at the time I was so optimistic, you know, that we had basically nailed it. But we keep discovering corner cases where frameworks, you know, certain libraries are doing clever things like peeking inside the APK and making assumptions, right? And so we keep tweaking and fixing and tweaking and fixing, and we did more of it in 2.2. And surprise, surprise, we have some more things coming in 2.3.
So this is just like a persistent feature. Every single time we'll have some instant run fixes.
Yeah, in fact, we shipped a 2.2 update, so 2.2.1 or 2.2.2, where we added a instant run flight recorder. So the idea there is if you are seeing some weird bug, you can go and enable the flight recorder, which is kind of like a black box in an airplane, right? That's recording some vitals as you're doing your operation. And then when it's done, you can upload your report. That basically gives us more information to track down the problem.
So have you seen reports from that yet?
Yeah, we're getting quite a few.
Nice. Yeah. And have you learned new things?
I think so. I haven't personally looked at the report, so I don't know, but I believe so.
Cool. Build cache. This is another one like, hey, we tried something cool. Try it out. Like very, very alpha. Actually, is that enabled in 2.3 yet? Or
I was going to say, I didn't think that was in 2.2. So think that's one of the big things we're working on for 2.3. Okay. And so the thing there is we're going to try to put a bunch of AAR artifacts in a shared directory. So that when you have multiple modules or multiple projects that are all accessing the same library, we keep having to index it. Because it's unique in each individual usage. Now, when everything goes to a standard place, it should be a lot less of that. So it should be a big improvement. But I don't think this is shipped yet.
Faster runtime for the tool? I thought it was specifically faster build time.
Yeah, build, but also the IDE. The IDE is busy indexing everything that's being built, right? And sort of there was just a lot of extra busy work being done with these very common libraries like AppCompat that's used over and over again. So I think the idea there is to sort of centralize it all. That should help a lot.
Okay. So it was off by default in 2.2. I don't know if it's on by default.
I see. Okay, so maybe that. So maybe we started the work in 2.2. I think it's still in progress for 2.3.
Okay, so there's like a build flag or a Gradle property flag you can set to enable that.
Cool.
And then virtual sensors. I guess there was new sensors enabled.
Oh, in the emulator.
Temperature. Yeah, yeah.
The emulator did some awesome stuff, right? Yeah. So, for example, you can now rotate the device, right? And you sort of get a nice 3D rendering of which position it's at. So there's quite a few new features in the emulator that lets you emulate a real device.
Can you also get a sensor for like cracked screen? So can you emulate the dropping of the phone onto the concrete and cracking the screen to see how your application behaves?
I honestly think that you are able to record gestures and replay them, but I don't know the details because I don't actually do real Android development.
This is an important one because I have kids that are cracking their screens on a regular basis right now.
So. It would be nice, right? I mean, we talked about in the layout editor to not just show you the layout, but show you the layout as seen by, for example, someone with a color blindness and maybe as seen in glare lighting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And sure, being able to like put a really bad cracked glass pattern on it.
Yeah.
Could be a cool thing too, yeah.
I think so too. We need the touch feedback as well because like it's not just the cracks, it's also the broken glass that you have to move your finger over.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a whole other experience for phones that we're trying to enable.
Yeah.
That was it for 2.2, so please do tell. Or actually, do you want to take a break now and talk about something else? Talk about support library. Yeah, let's tease the 2.3 stuff.
Okay, sure.
All right, let's come back to that. So lots of support library releases. Not specific to the MR1 or the 7.1 thing, but just since N. So it seems useful to go over some of the bigger stuff that's come out recently. The biggest one in my mind, maybe because I was sort of emotionally attached to it, is Transition. So in the 24.2 release, which came out, I don't know, 2 months ago, maybe three, we released Transition's backport. So the Transition's API came out in KitKat. And there were a couple of framework capabilities that it depended upon, which are difficult to backport. So there are some situations where it's not going to behave the same. But for the most part, it's there. It was a massive CL that someone developed to backport that. Yuichi in the team in Tokyo did a lot of work to make all that functionality work all the way back to ICS. So now you can put transitions in your app. A lot of people had been avoiding it because you have to be on the later releases, and they didn't want to re-architect their code when they're shipping on earlier releases. But now you can actually use transitions. The idea behind transitions is not to do like amazing, cool animations, but instead to make simple, functional animations much easier and more automatic. So in your application, you basically give it before, after states. You say, go, take a look at my UI now, and then I'm going to make a bunch of changes, take a look at it now, and then figure out the animations and run them automatically. And then you can customize those animations, and we encourage you to do so, but it's really about the system that simplifies animations down to the point of just saying before, after, go.
And your before, afters can be layouts?
Yeah, they can be layouts, or you can just do it dynamically. There's one single sort of magic method that says begin delay transition, which will simply take a look at your current layout before and after. And then, insert a listener and when layout runs, it says, okay, here's the after state, figure out the animations and go. But you can also hand it IDs for resource files, and it'll inflate the file, figure out, again, the deltas between either instances or the IDs of these objects and figure out the deltas, create the animations and run them. So that was kind of huge. My favorite thing about it was it came out with a release notes for 24.2, which basically said, there's a new transitions package. And then it linked to the package, which had Java docs for like the R file and the adder file and other completely useless information. So I wrote an article, at least given sort of a quick glance about what transitions was with an example. So that's on Medium. You can check that out for a little more helpful information. Let's see, Linkify. So we have Linkify capabilities already. Obviously, there's a API where you can send in a text string and it will send you back information about the links in there. And then you can, it'll send you back a spannable, and then you can set that on a text view. So basically, you can have us auto-link things like URLs and phone numbers. We've been doing a lot of work in the framework to make that more capable, to be more intelligent about different kinds of URLs and phone numbers. And we now created a Linkify Compat class so that you don't, you're not locked into using the framework version and all those new capabilities only being available on the new release. Instead, all of those have now been backported to Linkify Compat. The only caveat there is that if you are using auto-Linkify, which you can use through the set auto link mask API, that still uses the internal one. So if you're using that one, you're still sort of stuck on the framework capabilities. But for everything else, go ahead and use the new Linkify Compat. There was a major refactoring. We talked about this last year. I think we talked about it at I/O when we were talking about support library. There was a support library talk by Alan Vivrette. And we talked about upping the min SDK and moving around some of the packages. And we did that over the summer. So again, in the 24.2 release, it was a major cleanup operation. The min SDK has been bumped up to Gingerbread, so API 9. We wanted to bump it further, but there are some large and useful applications in the world that are still locked into Gingerbread. So we left it at Gingerbread right now. But by bumping the min SDK, we were allowed to eliminate a lot of overhead and methods in the support library that were there for earlier releases, which are irrelevant if we can assume that you're at least on Gingerbread. So basically, we got rid of overhead so that your application doesn't inherit it from us. We would like to keep moving this up in the future as it makes sense. So I think the most important thing about bumping up to Gingerbread wasn't that we moved it to API 9, but rather that it kind of sets a precedent for us to continue doing this over time. This is the first time that we've actually moved it at all. So I would expect this to move again when it makes sense. And then we can eliminate, once we move past Gingerbread, we can eliminate a lot of cruft and overhead and methods in the support library because of that. So look for that.
So unfortunately, we had baked in the min SDK version number like in the package name. So there's a bunch of V7 stuff. Did we get rid of that, or did we just say, too hard to break people's
code?
Well, now it's just a historical.
It is a historical weirdness in the library. It's one of those things in API development. Like, if we could do this again, we wouldn't do it that way. But we did actually take a run at doing a more major refactoring and moving package names and stuff, but it would have been pretty hellish for every developer to deal with. Like, we could have simplified some of it through the tools, but it would have been a lot of work for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So we just decided to not break everybody. And similarly, we also created more modular, smaller packages. So it used to be that you would include support V4, and that would give you everything, most of which you didn't need. And we now split support V4 into support compat, support core utils, support core UI, medium compat, and fragment. And now you can select the ones that you actually want out of there. There are some interdependencies, so you will still be in a situation where, you know, if you're using app compat, you're going to drag in, you know, one or two of these other ones anyway. But in a lot of situations, you know, maybe all you're using is core utils, and you're going to get a much smaller footprint and method count because you're only dragging in that specific package. We still left support V4.
We should have a lint check, which looks for that, right? To see if you're depending on the big package, only accessing stuff from a smaller package.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, because I think a lot of people don't know about this. There was a description of support library recently on Medium. Someone posted a nice, helpful, you know, overview of what support library is about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Margaret, and I missed her last name, and it's going to be embarrassing and haunt me. Anyway, helpful article. But it talks about using support V4, whereas it's time for people to actually use these smaller packages instead.
We should also update our project templates because I think we use the big packages. We should talk more often.
Let's do it.
Every other Wednesday for you.
Yeah, every other Wednesday around this time. That would be good.
Cool.
I should point out, too, that even though we broke it up into separate packages, we left support V4, again, because we don't want to break people. So now support V4 is basically a meta package that includes all this stuff. But if you are including that, please don't. Please look at the smaller footprint approach that you can use instead. Let's talk about 2.3.
Cool. All right. Actually, there's a kind of a good transition because, my favorite thing to talk about in 2.3 is probably lint. And there are some support library things. So one of the things is I found out that it's really important for the support libraries to all use the same version number. So we already had Lint check this for play services. You can't mix and match like, you know, ads version 8.9 and, you know, maps version 8.2 because they have a lot of shared code. And plus, they've all been ProGuarded together, so the symbols wouldn't match if you did that. So we now make sure that the support library versions are all the same. There actually are some new annotations in the new version of the support library. So this went into 25, and there are new Lint checks to enforce them. The first one is this restrict to annotation, and it basically lets you say, hey, this API is restricted. Even though it's public, I don't want just anyone to call it. So for example, you can say this API can only be accessed by subclasses. So, you know, in a lot of Android APIs, they are public, even though they're only meant to be overridden. So all the on methods in Activity, for example, right? So they're public so that some other classes can call them, but you're not really supposed to call them yourself. They really are meant for the framework to call and for you to override.
That's kind of an awkward Java-ism.
Yes.
Yeah, a language-ism.
Yes. So being able to say, hey, I really only expect people to call this or to override this, but not to call it, is one flavor of this annotation. So you say restrict to, then subclasses. There's another one that says, hey, I want to restrict this to tests, right? This method is only here for test usage. And, you know, you better be a test calling this or another method that's also been marked for tests. So you can actually include code that's meant for testing without accidentally having production code call it. Because we've all done this before, right? You add a method that's kind of hacky, but it's there for a unit test. And then someone else doesn't realize that hacky method isn't supposed to be used by anyone else, and they use it. And then suddenly now you have to support it. And maybe the real use case for this annotation was support library itself. Support library, after it was split up, has a bunch of internal guts that's only meant for the support library itself to use, right? But they have to be public because not just because they want to break up into smaller packages, but because other libraries in the support package, in the cluster of libraries, want to call this, but they don't want to make this API forever.
Right.
So now this lets us say that this API is restricted to the same library group. Right. So in Studio now, if you try to call one of these internal support library classes, it'll say this is restricted. And the way we implemented that is we just annotated a bunch of packages in the support library. All the internal packages have been annotated with restrict to. And then Lint looks for it. And, you know, you find out if you're using any of these.
Nice.
Yeah.
Was this an IntelliJ annotation that we inherited? Or is this
this is a new one in the Android support annotations.
Nice.
Yeah. The other one isn't actually new. We've had visible for testing for a while. But the new flavor of it is that you can say visible for testing otherwise, and then you can say what the intended visibility should have been. Right? So normally, you could say that this method, I think usually when you just say visible for testing, you mean that it's visible, otherwise it should have been private. Right? But you could say that if this wasn't, let's say you have a protected method in your class, right? So it's meant to be protected in your production code. Right, so you're allowed to access it from a subclass or from within the package. But then suddenly a test that isn't in the same package needs to access it, so you make it public.
Yep.
Right, but it's so you don't want to say visible for testing because it wasn't supposed to be private; it's supposed to be protected. So now you get to say this is visible for testing, but I wanted it to be protected. And what Lint will do now is, if it sees some production code accessing it that would require public, it'll flag it.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, we have a hard time with protected in the framework codes.
There's a policy there, right? So to go back to the restrict to subclasses again, they decided at some point they learned not to make things protected because, you know, if you make something protected and change your mind later, you cannot make it public because anyone who was overriding it, if they made it protected as well, you're now breaking compilation. So that's why I think one of the rules of thumb for the Android API design, right, is to make these kinds of methods public.
Yeah, if it's going to be a public API, it's going to be a public method, not a protected.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons that we ran into problems that caused this policy was because of support library, where we would create a compatibility version of framework capabilities, and then we would need to call framework stuff sort of as if we're a subclass, but we're not. We're in a separate package, right? We're in the static library over to the left somewhere, but we really want to call in as if we're a subclass, or actually we just want to access the same method as if we're part of framework, but we're not.
Right.
And so at that point, it's really better for us to be dealing with public methods that we can, you know, deal with in the proper way.
Yep.
Cool.
So those are the new annotations. There are a bunch of new Lint checks, and I think one that Chet's going to like... This is the one that helps you with Object Animator. right? So Object Animator is an API that is basically hiding, well, it looks like it's hiding reflection. Now, you told me it's not actually reflection behind the scenes.
It's JNI. It's even worse than reflection. Yes. It's JNI.
But the point is you have string typing, right? Like you say, yep. I want to access this property on this other class, and yep. you name that property by a string.
Yep.
Right. So if you have a typo in the string, or if the class moves or whatever, or if it has the wrong modifiers, you don't know this until at runtime you get like a log message saying, hey, I couldn't find this property.
Yep.
So Lint now is sort of doing some data flow analysis, and it actually ensures that these methods exist, have the right signature and so forth.
Nice.
Which, you know, fine. You know, it saves you that, you know, that run where it would log and not work. But the real motivating feature for this was
ProGuard.
ProGuard, yay. Exactly. So you're accessing an attribute and it's working fine when you're testing this on your device. And then you ship to production and it doesn't work. And the reason for that often is that you are doing a release build, you enabled ProGuard. ProGuard sees your property, but it doesn't think anyone's using it, right? Because that method was it was called only through reflection or, you know, JNI flexion. So ProGuard says, hey, I can rename this to something shorter. I can maybe even delete it. Right? And so at runtime, this crashes. And so what you really want is to annotate your object animator attributes with the keep annotation. So that tells our build system, hey, this is actually used. Don't mess with it. So what this new lint rule does is it makes sure that whenever it sees an object animator reference, it actually makes sure that the corresponding method has been annotated with keep if you're using resource shrinking.
Nice. We yeah. talked about doing that when the object animator stuff first went in, what, 6 years ago. And it's thanks for finally doing that.
Yep. Yeah. And there actually are a bunch of new lint checks. I'm not going to list them all. The only other thing I'll talk about for lint is a feature I'm really excited about, which is actually, I'll just motivate it first. So let's say you have a big code base, right? Because I've seen people ask about this. You have a code base and you have thousands of lint warnings. And so you mean to go back there and fix it. But how do you get started immediately if you want to break the bill, if anyone makes it? You don't want to get things worse. You want to make sure you're not adding new issues. Right? So there's this new feature now where you can say, hey, make me a baseline. You know, record what all the issues are right now into a file. And from now on, and then you check that baseline file along with the project files. From now on, it'll only report issues that weren't in that original baseline. So if you add a new warning, that one is going to show up. But all the other issues are hidden from now. So it sort of lets you say, okay, we are where we are, but going forward, no one gets to add any more problems. We're gonna show just those.
So pound to find 1,000 to zero, basically.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, this feature has existed in some other code review tools like this, and I was looking into what to call it, and you know, a common word for this is like the grandfathered issues, mm-hmm. right? So you can grandfather things. There's like this yeah. grandfather clause. And I was looking into the history of that. Turns out that's like a super racist past. Grandfathering had to do with basically like disenfranchising voters, right? Huh. It was like it has a racial background. So it's like, okay, I'm not calling this feature grandfathering. So that's why it's called baseline. The idea is, you know, sort of set the baseline for where things are now and make sure you don't exceed it.
We could have done something there, like, you know, lying to yourself or, you know, somebody, let's be honest about what you're doing when you do this.
Yes.
You're hiding the real truth.
Yes. So what Lint does
sweep under the rug. I'm just tossing it out there. Right?
Yes. What Lint does do, though, is it does file one warning for you with severity information. It says, I filtered out 1,100 issues. So you get to see. And in the IDE, there's a quick fix for that warning that says run Lint again without baseline, and then you get to see all the issues.
That's the slowest quick fix in the world.
Yes.
Like, yeah, fix these 1,100 yeah. issues.
The other thing is that, you know when Lint runs in the background while you're editing, that one ignores the baseline, because if you're touching a file, you ought to fix the warning, so it's not going to hide them for you there. So anyway, that's the baseline support. Like I said, there's a bunch of other Lint issues, but there's Lint warnings. There's other features in the IDE as well. For example, we have added WebP support. So we will tell you now if you are using, there's two warnings around WebP, right? So WebP requires MinSDK 15, or if you have transparency in your images, or if you want to do lossless encoding, you have to have API 18. It's actually Android 4.2.1, but that sort of works out to, even though API 18 is 4.3, API 17 is 4.2.0, so we had to go to API 18. Anyway, so if we see that you're using PNGs that are either not transparent or you have MinSDK 18 and you have transparent, we'll say, hey, you might want to consider switching to WebP. And likewise, if we find WebP images with a format that implies an API level, we will enforce those. Now, more importantly, you can right-click on your resource folder and say, you know, convert to WebP. And then we show you the settings dialog where you can sort of configure your encoding preferences, whether you want lossy encoding or, you know, lossless encoding and so forth. And if you're going for lossy encoding, we show you a diff. We run through all the images. We show you on the left and right the, you know, the PNG image, the encoded WebP image, and there's a slider. You can drag the quality slider back and forth to see, and we show you a diff in the middle, or like what, where are the pixels different, right? But WebP encoding is really, really good, so that's, you hardly cool. ever, you know, need to go above 75%.
I wonder how hard it would be to motivate it. So not just say, have you considered WebP, which sounds almost like an ad, but say, have you considered WebP, because you could save up to, like, you should be able to calculate how big these things are now and how big they would be in WebP with, you know, default settings or something, or lowest settings, you know,
yeah.
You know the range.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. So when you actually go to the conversion, we show you the savings on each file. Yeah. And at the end, there's a summary. Yeah, we can maybe make the lint warning that says, hey, you should switch stronger.
Yeah.
So that's the WebP encoding. We've also integrated in IntelliJ, the 2016.2, which is the current stable IntelliJ release. So that gives you features like, my favorite is ligatures, right? So less than equal, which are two different mm-hmm. characters, you know, in a normal code editor, becomes a single symbol, right? So it just sort of looks nicer and cleaner. There's a bunch of other features in IntelliJ that are kind of nice. So those are included. What am I forgetting here? There's a bunch of fixes in data binding, actually, in addition to a bunch
So I'm going to ask you the same question. I get this whenever I go to a conference, and I got this two separate times at DroidCon recently. Someone said, should I start using data binding yet, or is it still not finished? I'm like, it's been usable for a year and a half. Why do people think this? And I think part of it is tool support, right? Because that's probably their frontline view of everything that they use in Android.
Yeah.
Right. So does this get it to the point where, like, it is ready to use? People can and should be using it. But does this get it closer to the point where it's obvious from using the tool?
I hope so. You know, we should probably have Yeet back on and talk about data binding again, because he's been doing a lot of the bug fixing on this as well. Yeah. There probably still is a gap, but there's probably certain things that aren't quite right yet, but I think it's pretty close now. The biggest feature, so in addition to all the bug fixes, the main feature in 2.3 for data binding is that you can choose in settings whether or not you want to, you know, actually edit, debug with the generated data binding files, or just use the implicitly on-the-fly computed ones. When you're debugging, you kind of want to see what it was data binding did. But when you're editing, you don't want to have stale files, right? So that's a feature that they've added. Am I running out of ideas now? 2.3, we just shipped 2.2, so there aren't that many things yet. And we're really still focusing strongly on stability. There were some features that shipped in preview mode that, for example, the UI, the Espresso Test Recorder, that were stabilizing to make it a stable release feature.
There was a bug fix release after 2.2. I know there was some constraint layout issues, and then there was like a fast follow.
Yeah, we've done both 2.2.1, where we added the flight test recorder, and 2.2.2, where we added some more bug fixes. And we even have a 2.2.3 maybe in the works, sort of backporting a few things that we've done in 2.3 that we want to make available to people before 2.3 itself is the thing that people switch to for primary work.
And constraint layout actually went beta in 2.2, right? So it's like more official? It's not official?
In 2.2, it was off by default. I mean, you can use
it. Maybe
it
was 2.2.1.
When you make a new project, you don't get constraint layout.
But like it went...
We've recently shipped beta. That was post 2.2. Okay. So we now shipped constraint layout 1.0, beta 3, I think. Okay. And the hope is to bring it to final very, very soon.
Right. And when it is final, then it will be used by default in the templates, right?
That's right. In 2.3, we're hoping to make it the default again. And with a... you know, stable release of 2.3.
If they grab the Canary, is it used in the templates there? Because it was at one point.
I think it is, yeah. I think Canary builds, we never turn it off.
Yeah, okay. All right. So that's 2.3.
Yeah, I think so. Cool. So we're hoping to do a preview soon.
Okay.
And there's, you know, all kinds of stuff being done on the build system as well to make things faster.
Okay.
So it's Canary. Ways.
It's Canary channel. Certainly, by the time this podcast is live, it'll be in Canary, and then maybe more officially preview after that.
Actually, what we're calling preview, we're switching terminology. So what we used to call preview, we're calling Canary now. So
okay,
it'll be a Canary build, and then eventually we'll have a beta. But you know, that's not in the works yet.
Sounds good. I'm going to go back to some of the stuff I didn't talk about before.
Yeah.
So there was more support library stuff. We had support library version 25 came out a few weeks ago. One of the things that came out was the bottom navigation bar. People have been asking for this for a while because there was an app or two that came out with this thing, sort of the, you know, the tabs on the bottom of your application. I think G Plus was the first one. And then it came out in Material Spec sometime later and said, well, you know, here's this idea if you would like to use it. And then the obvious question to ask after that is, okay, well, what is Google providing to make it easier to get this standard thing that is being suggested for a material? And the answer was always, yeah, we'll think about that. But in fact, we were in the middle of developing it and finally came out with that. And there were some bugs in the first one that came out in version 25, and there are some fixes. I can't remember whether we did a bug fix release already or there's one in the works out sometime soon. But the idea is not to get I have this horror show image in my mind of like doing the thing with tab bars that IE did with toolbars back in the day, where you know you'd go to your parents' computer and they would have installed all this crapware and have like 17 toolbars installed, and the amount of space for the actual HTML content was quite small. Please don't do that. But hopefully there's just, you know, sort of the two readily available options. Maybe you have tabs on the top. That's sort of a more general purpose tab approach. And then the bottom navigation bar is specifically for like 3 to 5 top level destinations. You click on this thing, it's an atomic action to go there. It's not going to be scrollable. My favorite thing about this is it already uses existing Android paradigms, where you tell it that you have a bottom navigation view, and then you point it to a menu file, and it's just a standard menu view, resource file with items. So you basically create the bottom navigation bar just the same as you create other menu based resources in Android applications. So fairly straightforward. And then finally, IME image insertion. So we came up with a new capability in the framework, and then we backported that in a slightly different way so that you can get this in earlier releases. And this is the ability to have a keyboard insert images into your application. And it's a little complicated because it is a two-way conversation between the application and the IME or the keyboard. They both need to know about these capabilities. The application needs to expose the capability to actually paste this content in there or to accept this content. So it needs to expose to the IME that it can accept these MIME types, these image types. And then the keyboard or the IME needs to understand that the application didn't do this and then provide a way to supply that content. So there's sort of a protocol, a handshake that's going to go on back and forth, where the application is going to expose the content types that it has in the editor info object, and then the IME is going to see that editor info object, and then it's going to call commit content with this stuff. And then on the application side, if you're using the compat approach, you implement a listener that's going to get the information later and then do the appropriate thing with it. So check that out in version 25 if you want to deal with this. And then finally, my favorite thing that came out in version 25 is recycler view prefetch. So this is another sort of techie detail like the touch latency stuff, where clever engineers in the graphics team said, you know what, it would be faster if we didn't have to do layout for all these new items, like as we're scrolling or flinging recycler view. It would be faster if we could actually do this ahead of time. So if I see that there's an item coming up that's just outside the screen, and I know that I have some downtime in the UI thread to do some layout stuff, why don't I do that now so that just in case that view comes into view, comes onto the screen soon, we've already done the information that's necessary. And in this way, we can take these large synchronous blocks that we have in the UI thread processing this stuff and break it into blocks instead that can be done in parallel. So if you do prefetch at a time when the UI thread is not doing something, and then that information is needed on a later frame, then it's already done. So the layout block is much smaller, obviously, because we've already laid it out. So this is just sort of a clever optimization tweak that they did that made it possible to get much more timely recycle review frames in version 25. So check that out. I think that's all I got for support library.
I just thought of one more thing. It's really fast. This was like the top bug for Studio, which it's a simple thing, but we added a search feature to the vector import dialog box. Like for some reason, this was a feature people were really excited about. There was even like Reddit threads complaining about this. So we got that done in this release. So people will be happy to see that. Yeah.
Can you...
Just like when you have this dialog and there's like hundreds of icons in there. And if you wanted to find something, you have to just sit there and click through each category and look. Now you can type words.
Nice.
Like arrow. And you'll find all the icons that are have something to do with arrows. So it's a simple thing. It was like 3 hours worth of work with unit tests. Nice. But, you know.
So please file bugs, because that's how we find out that there are actually issues.
Yes.
All right. So I think that takes care of recent stuff. We're working on other stuff that we'll talk about some other time.
And then we'll hopefully have a guest next time.
Maybe.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I want to say thank you to the guest that we didn't have. Thanks.